Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence and whose service in a variety of different capacities in that war for the free world has long impressed me is our first guest. He is Pete Hegseth. You have seen him, I'm quite certain, on Fox News, where he is a very important contributor. Perhaps you have been reading his writings at places like foxnews.com, but also National Review and elsewhere. And I hope, if you haven't yet, that you will be racing out to a bookstore or Amazon to get a copy of his new book, In the Arena, Good Citizens, a Great Republic, and How One Speech Can Reinvigorate America. Pete served with great distinction in the United States Army, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. He has been a leader of veterans since he got out, notably with Concerned Veterans for America and Vets for Freedom. He is a man I'm very proud to call a friend as well as a much admired colleague, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Welcome back, Pete, and congratulations on In the Arena.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. I appreciate it. It's great to be on with you.
So, give us the short course on what In the Arena refers to, as well as why it's important that we all do our part to be playing in it.
That's right. Well, you certainly are, and folks like you have been in the arena. You live in the arena, in the arena of ideas for our American experiment and what it takes to preserve it. The title of the book itself, In the Arena, comes from a famous quote from Teddy Roosevelt in 1910. You're probably familiar with it. It starts, "It's not the critic who counts, the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by blood and sweat and dust, who strives valiantly for worthy causes." And it goes on a little bit more than that. And I carried that quote with me in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. It always motivated me to make sure I was doing everything I could to be in the arena, fighting for worthy causes, striving valiantly. And then when I got back from Afghanistan, I actually read the entire speech. And the entire speech is called Citizenship in a Republic, given by Roosevelt in 1910. And the book is not about me, nor is it about Roosevelt necessarily. I mean, I'm a conservative. I come at Roosevelt with clear eyes about his descent into the founder of the Progressive Party and his Bull Moose candidacy and all of that. This is just about the speech. And the speech was sort of, it's an un-PC speech before there even was PC. And it lays out the two very important aspects that I kind of pull out of it. One are the gritty values that are needed as citizens to perpetuate a republic. What type of men and women do we need to be raising and perpetuating in this country in order to make sure our American experiment continues? And he goes into some detail with language that we need to hear more of today, not the soft sort of bike helmet, fifth place trophy language, but the gritty, tough, duty, honor language that we need more of today. And then he also talks about good patriots. And as you know, Teddy Roosevelt was always an advocate for American leadership in the world. He talks about the need for us to reject the so-called citizens of the world and instead be proud of America, unapologetic, and willing to stand for and win the fights that we undertake. So in my mind, those are two pretty important ingredients about making sure America stays strong. And then if America leads in the world, that's necessary for freedom to continue to flourish in the world, as you're very well aware of. So rather than me just write a book about what I thought it was better to revive a historic speech that, just like in most things in life, we're bringing back to life timeless truths. I tried to do that with the Roosevelt speech.
Well, thank you for doing it, Pete Hegseth, because this really is such a bracing and remarkable contrast to what we have been seeing and hearing from Barack Obama throughout this presidency, as well as others like him. Let me talk to you about one piece of this first of the two important themes. Whether we still have it in us as citizens of this country, in the sense of understanding how much is at stake, and in particular, how what we're choosing to do or not do as citizens may really determine whether we have the strength, whether we have the fortitude, whether we have the perceived deterrent capabilities to prevent bad guys from taking advantage of us and to our great detriment at that.
You're exactly right. That's why Roosevelt started with that in his speech and why I lead within the book as well, because the heroic virtues of the battlefield, of leadership on the world stage, you can't sustain those over time without the more civic or homely or martial virtues here at home that we are failing to instill in the next generation. See, when I use the word citizenship, a lot of people today think of maybe voting or jury duty or protesting or marches, and those are all things that happened in republics and democracies. However, what Roosevelt was referring to was not those outward-facing motions, but first, how we hold our own as individuals. Are we willing to earn a living and not be dependent on the government, but instead provide for our family? Will we fight for causes that we believe in, either through force of arms or in principle in our sphere of influence? Will we raise large, healthy, patriotic families? Roosevelt talks about demographics, and you can look at Western Europe today, and you know, your statistics you're very familiar with the most common new boy's name in London being Muhammad, who's having kids and how many still matters in the world today, even if so many want to believe that we live in history. And then he also talks about character and faith. Free peoples can't govern yourselves in a free society unless people have inside some sort of a moral compass that they adhere to, as opposed to depending on Big Brother to establish and enforce a moral code. Those are all inward things that we can affect in our own sphere that make us good citizens in Roosevelt's articulation that are sorely lacking today. Instead, we want to point at other people or other problems so restoring that sense of citizenship, it comes through education, it's families, it's you know, whether it's homeschooling or proper schooling or civic organizations or churches. You have to understand why America is special and why she is exceptional in order to make the kind of unapologetic arguments that it will take to reinvigorate it. So it's an education process top to bottom, but it really starts with the individual and making sure we're affecting what we can where we are.
Pete Hegseth, just on this point, you used a term that is almost never spoken of these days, certainly outside of the United States military, and especially in the context of what we should be instilling in our young people and expecting them to exhibit, and that is a certain martial quality, that is to say, an understanding of and practice of, you know, the manly business, I guess, if you'd call it that, of defending us. And I really wonder sometimes whether we've kind of been weaning out of the body politic, the DNA, if you will, of, I think of it at a kind of higher order, a national security mindedness. But when you get down to it at the individual level, it really is some of those qualities you're talking about. Is it gone? And if it is lacking, beyond sort of the general point about education and family values and so on, what would you recommend be done to reinstill it?
Sure. I don't think it's entirely gone. It lives in certain quarters of society, geographically and temperamentally. You still got military families and lineages that instill it. You still have certain, you know, whether it's Texas or other places where that ethos is still appreciated. But it's not entirely gone, but in many ways we are turning our men into women and our women into men, and creating a space in which those values of strength and of honor and of decisive action and of courage are undervalued or seen as boisterous or too brutish for a refined society like ours. I mean, John Kerry also encapsulated it when he called, you know, action, military action, so 19th century. They sort of believe, they understand all of these things to be past us. What do we have to do? Civic education is critical, but I don't believe in universal national service because I think it inevitably leads, first of all, I don't think it's constitutional. Second of all, I think it inevitably leads to just government growth and a bunch of social justice causes. But I do argue for a more decisive selective service decision point where if you're of the age, you know, about to be 18, 19, 20, you're confronted with a more robust series of choices. Maybe you sign up for something like a Minuteman Corps, which isn't the full-time military. I know so many guys who are able-bodied, patriotic, would serve in a time of of crisis if they were ever asked to, but they're not involved at all. But you give them an opportunity to, say, take an annual fitness test, something where it triggers their thought.
I'm going to pause for just a moment. We have to break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Pete Hegseth about reinstilling in our country what we need to protect it, among other things, in a dangerous world, and the necessity for engagement to that end right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest is Pete Hegseth. We are having an extended conversation with him, I'm delighted to say, about his new book, In the Arena. as well as some of the insights that he's gained from his time in service to our country in the United States Army and the service that he has been rendering ever since, including with organizations like Vets for Freedom and Concerned Veterans for America. Pete, thanks again for your time. Let me just ask you about one thing that you touched on a moment ago, and that is improving our selective service system. And there's much talk at the moment, as you know, of drafting women in the event we have to kick that thing into gear again. What are your thoughts on that, Pete?
Well, it's all part of a longstanding social engineering policy this administration has had from the very beginning. Much more worried about issues of equality or diversity in the military than they are about warfighting capability. I also don't trust that they will maintain the standards, and inevitably moving women into combat roles will inevitably erode to some level of erosion of standards because quotas take hold and all the things that you're aware of. I think it's a bad idea. I think it might. I know it was introduced almost to demonstrate what a bad idea it was. Now it could go to an actual, it could actually become policy or pursued. I know this administration, a lot of times, you know, their perspectives when taken to a logical conclusion don't look so pretty. And in this particular case, I don't think there's a lot of fathers and mothers would be interested in daughters being drafted for the next World War, were it ever, heaven forbid, to come to that. So I don't think it's a good idea necessarily, but I also think it's pretty hard to avoid once they've gone down all the trails they have already.
Our guest is Pete Hegseth. We're talking about his new book, In the Arena. And Pete, when you described the two sort of pillars of Teddy Roosevelt's famous speech, which gave rise to that quote, you mentioned not only the importance of an engaged citizenry with a certain martial aspect and conviction about the extraordinary nature of this country, but also the importance of this country being engaged in the world as a force for good. Talk a bit about the latter, if you would.
Yeah, that's right. It's important to have that conversation because we're in a moment, both on the left and on the right, where political leaders are wanting to pull us away from engagement with the world. And we've had difficult outcomes in difficult wars since 9/11 that have, you know, brought about appetites for retreat. And what I try to enforce in the book is that it is resolve that needs to be the lessons since 9/11 and not retreat. And I talk about the Iraq War, an issue you and I were very intimately involved with. But ultimately, we won the war there through the surge and overwhelmingly so against al-Qaeda in Iraq. And even Joe Biden in February of 2010 said Iraq would be an overwhelming success for that administration. And then they abandoned it and retreated militarily and diplomatically, and you got the rise of ISIS through the vacuum and us not being willing to follow through and finish the job. So it litigates that over the course of a chapter and a half, because I think that is important lest we fall into this delusion that Iraq was an inevitable disaster no matter what. And Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya are very different combat zones also, but Roosevelt saw those same tendencies in his time. He warned against citizens of the world who he called utterly undesirable citizens of their own country, but who ultimately believe that some sort of one world or perspective is capable of solving the problems of the world, when in reality there are very different violent ideologies facing off, and you either face up against them and show a willingness to prevail, or slowly your freedoms will erode. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves right now is, are we able to prevail or to do what is necessary? Because enemies lurk, as you know better than anyone else, around the globe today.
Yeah, slowly may not be the best adjective to describe how fast this takes place. It seems to be accelerating as with each passing day. Pete Hegseth, let me just ask you about one of those ideologies. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Teddy Roosevelt warned about it rather explicitly in his time, namely this program that its adherents call Sharia, an Islamic supremacist doctrine that you've confronted on battlefields around the world, and notably at Guantanamo Bay, of course. What is your reading, as you look particularly as a man who hails from the great state of Minnesota, at what is happening, not just on some distant land where those who seek to make Sharia supreme are at work, but actually here in the United States as well, notably in Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Yeah, one of the big three threats I list in the book is Islamism in either violent or political forms. And, you know, you look at Western Europe and the bombings that occurred most recently, and those are indicative of societies where there was no There was no assimilation, followed by no allegiance. And it becomes a first generation, then a second generation problem. And I live here in Minnesota. In Minneapolis, there's a large Somali Muslim population. I just did a feature for Fox News Channel where I went down to that area and interviewed a lot of Somali Minnesotans about, you know, what they see and what they see in the mosques there. And there's some unfortunate and scary stuff. I mean, what you pretty much have, not universally, there's some good people down there for sure. But in the first generation, you don't see a whole lot of assimilation. They did flee Somalia after the Civil War in 1991. And they see a peaceful and better life here, but they're not speaking English. They're not really engaging with the outside community, even after 15 years here in this country. And then it's the second generation that is being raised with propaganda, with no necessary allegiance here because their parents aren't engaged, but also not back home. So the propaganda is powerful. And the mosques, you've got imams preaching radical Islam there, and then there's terror networks recruiting them. So you've got this hotbed where there is neither assimilation nor allegiance then, therefore, to the principles of America, which have everything to do with what this country's always stood for, and nothing to do with, of course, the racism or bigotry that everyone would want to accuse us of. So it's a perfect example of how vigilant we need to be, and how as a culture and as a society, as Americans who believe in our experiment, we have to be willing to confront those who won't assimilate to the ideas of our country and show allegiance to them, lest we find ourselves in a place where there's a silent invasion of groups of people who have a very different view of the future that look nothing like America, nothing like freedom.
Pete Hegseth, you have beautifully sort of stitched together the two elements of Teddy Roosevelt's famous speech in this particular crucible. You've got to have people who are willing to stand up for our country, and we've got to be engaging those enemies, foreign and domestic, as you swore to do, to safeguard our country against them. And I just want to ask you quickly about political Islam, as you put it. This piece that worries me, frankly, as much as the violent sort of jihad is what the Muslim Brotherhood calls civilization jihad. And it's a kind of stealthy sort of counterpart to it. And you mentioned Europe, the infrastructure that made possible much of that jihadism of the violent kind is in mosques, is in community centers, cultural centers, so on. And in places like Minneapolis, we have them, I'm afraid, incubating as the next generation, if you will, of jihadists as well. Looking at this kind of as a national security practitioner, as well as, you know, a citizen advocate, what would you recommend be done in a city like Minneapolis-St. Paul to contend with this phenomenon?
Yeah, it's community centers, it's cultural centers. You know, CARE here in Minneapolis is adamant that there's no radicalization like they are everywhere else, serving as a Muslim Brotherhood front group. It's here. I would, you know, it's happening in our communities. I mean, you've got, there was a at Blaine High School here just down the road from us, there was a World Celebration Day where, you know, the Muslim call to prayer was given from the stage, which would never, of course, would be afforded Christians or Jews or any other faith. You've got prayer, religious observations giving away at public schools here to Muslim students whose parents agitate adamantly for it in ways that hasn't happened for Christians for decades because God has been removed from school. So, again, it comes down to a citizen individual duty level to call these things out. And do so with a heart for what America stands for, not out of hate for anybody else, but because we love what we have and that we can't allow it to fade away through a different sort of allegiance.
Pete Hegseth, congratulations on your new book, In the Arena, Good Citizens, A Great Republic, and How One Speech Can Reinvigorate America. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. We'll have more with this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Anyone still attracted to the illusion of socialism and its promise of social justice and wealth redistribution needs to check out what's happening in Venezuela. 17 years of Bolivian revolutionary repression and ripping off an oil-rich nation have left its people without food, electrical power, or even toilet paper. Now the despotic regime founded by the radical leftist Hugo Chavez has declared a state of emergency. He justified this extreme measure by asserting the United States was organizing a coup, a preposterous claim given President Obama's friendly attitude towards Chavez and his successor, Nicolas Maduro. The people of Venezuela have already expressed how fed up they are with Maduro's misrule. Last year, they gave control of parliament to a coalition of opposition parties now pursuing a legal means of removing Maduro from power. They, not the regime, deserve our support. This is Frank Affney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Daniel Akbari. Daniel is an extraordinarily interesting fellow. He was a Sharia lawyer in Iran, where he practiced as best he could. Law then fled the country. Coming to the United States, he is now studying law here, as a matter of fact, and hoping to practice American constitutional law. He is the author of two books, Honor Killing, A Professional's Guide to Sexual Relations and Gyra Violence from the Islamic Sources, and also New Jihadists and Islam. Mr. Akbari, it's good to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, brother.
I'd like to get a couple of terms nailed down as best we can from a man who is intimately familiar with them from inside Iran. Maybe starting with one that I think is extraordinarily important, as I know you do, namely Sharia. What would that term mean to you and to those Muslims who are seeking to impose it on the rest of us?
Yes. In the United States, Muslim Brotherhood tries to define Sharia as the way of life. And they just try to say that's how Muslims practice their lives. But the truth is that Sharia is the collection of rules and commands coming from the authentic Islamic sources, from Quran and Sunnah. So whatever Muhammad said should be done or should not be done, and his way of life should be collected as some commands and rules, and every Muslim has to follow it to be able to please Allah. So we have it in many, many different Islamic denominations, like Shafi'i, Hanafi, Maliki. They all have specific books, like Americans are familiar with the book, The Reliance of the Traveler. It starts from how to pray, how to punish somebody who steals, how to kill somebody who is non-Muslim, how to fast, how to do pilgrimage. All aspects of life is covered by Sharia.
And it is an obligatory practice under the terms of Islam, and that would be true whether you are from the Shia tradition, as you were in Iran, as I understand it, or the Sunni or Sufi or others. There is a general understanding with respect to Sharia and its primacy, is there not?
The difference between Shia and Sunni is only political, so they don't have problem with differences with their religion. So we go and lump them all together and say Shia and Sunni. After somebody became Muslim, has to do the five pillars, doing the Shahada, Zakat, prayer, fasting, and pilgrimage to be able to be immune from the Islamic attacks. But the day after they are immune, they have to follow specific rules to be able to live in Islamic community safely and then have a small hope to go to paradise. So Sharia is everything, is totally Islamic command.
And when you say it's political, I want to make sure that we're clear about this, because there are those, including the authorities of the faith, who say this is the same thing as Islam. Sharia is Islam. Islam is Sharia. And yet, this is really not a religion. It is correct, if I understand it, to describe it more accurately as a political and perhaps a military as well as a legal program. Would that be consistent with your experience of it, Daniel Akbari?
That's it. When I said about different political differences, I said, for example, Shia believes that Ali, I mean, at that time, was appointed to be the first caliph, and Sunni people say Abu Bakr. That's the only difference we can say. But when it comes to religion, Sharia is a political system. It is established to rule and govern.
And when you hear people use terms like moderate Islam, is there such a thing as moderate Islam within the dictates of Sharia?
People, when they refer to moderate Muslims specifically, they go to those who might have never even prayed or might not even believe in Islam at all. When it comes to moderate Islam, there is no such a thing as moderate Islam if we say that's correct. If somebody has a specific understanding of Islam other than what Sharia says, is a heresy, and it's not going to be accepted. I'm not just going to diminish. I'm just going to give credit to great people like Zohi Jasser. He, if people call him a moderate Muslim, that's perfect. But when it comes to Muslim Brotherhood, people like Kale, who just have some tie or shave sometimes or put on jeans, it's not about, that's not about being moderate or being moderate. If somebody follows Sharia, has to believe in cutting the hands of thieves, has to believe in stoning, has to believe in beheading. So there is no such a thing as moderate Islam if we say that's equivalent to Sharia. If we say Islam is what I practice based on what my father said, based on my own belly, that's a different thing. That's not even Islam. So there is no such a thing as moderate Islam if somebody believes in the whole Quran as a book applicable to 21st century.
This really is the crux of the matter, it seems to me. I think we would be safe in saying that there are lots of Muslims around the world, Zohi Jasser being, you know, an exemplar of them in this country, who practice what they believe is their faith tradition of Islam in a manner that is very moderate, very much a patriotic, law-abiding, tolerant practice, and you know, quite laudable, it seems to me. On the other hand, his attitude towards Sharia and that I think of most of the folks who would fall into this category is, as he put it in his reform manifesto recently, the moderate reform manifesto, is that Sharia is man-made law. Now, that would seem to be the height of apostasy as far as the fundamentalists, if you will, the orthodox, the authorities of the faith are concerned, would it not?
Right. The Muslim Brotherhood is taking advantage of this confusion and this turgid water that people, Americans, they do not have that much education about Muslim and Islam. by definition, if somebody does not pray, is not a Muslim. And I can guarantee more than half of Muslims never pray. So by Islamic definition, if we say there are 1.2 billion or 1.6 billion Muslims on the planet, by Islam's own definition, half of them who do not pray are not Muslims. But, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is taking advantage of that misunderstanding in the community and saying, oh, look at your neighbor. We are all peaceful. Everything is going perfect. We don't have any problem with 60% of those so-called Muslims who might never pray. If somebody is a Muslim, but does not practice Sharia or does not take Islam's interpretation orthodox, I mean, we don't have any problem. We have problem with 40%, 35% of those so-called Muslims who have an orthodox understanding from which Sharia and jihad comes on the stage.
Daniel Akbari, I want to come back to the Muslim Brotherhood in a moment, but just spend a moment, if you would, as well, helping us understand what jihad is within this tradition of Sharia.
The whole world, based on Islamic teachings, the whole world is belonging to Allah. So all the world has to be ruled by Sharia and under Islam. So every attack to other countries to bring them under the flag, under the banner of Allah, is called a defense jihad, because they say we are the owner of the whole world. So wherever we attack is a defensive jihad. Attacking to Israel because Israel is belonging to Allah. Attacking Jewish to send them out of that country is jihad. Jihad is fighting against non-Muslims to kill them.
Is it fair to say that while the most efficient means of jihad is, of course, the violent kind, that there are other methods for advancing this same purpose, including hijra, the migration of people, the practice of, you mentioned it earlier, one of the pillars of the faith, zakat, raising charitable contributions, some of which would go to jihad. And then this bit about the Muslim Brotherhood and civilization jihad, as they call it, a kind of stealthy, subversive sort of jihad. Daniel, we have to pause for just a second. I've sort of teed this up, but I am anxious to have you walk us through the various means by which the Sharia-adherent Muslims believe they must practice jihad and the dangers that it represents, particularly some of those other kinds, the nonviolent kinds or the pre-violent kinds for societies like ours. Daniel Akbari is our guest. We'll have more with him right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has in 2015 begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Every year, more American adults die from vaccine-preventable diseases than from breast cancer, traffic accidents, or AIDS. Vaccines like the one for pneumococcal disease can protect adults from illnesses that can cause missed days of work, hospitalization, and even death. Pneumococcal disease is an infection that can lead to pneumonia, meningitis, or even a severe blood infection. That's just one example of an infection that can spread from person to person. Getting vaccinated can help protect you and those close to you. I'm Dr. Susan Rehm of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. When I speak with my patients, I urge them to get all their recommended vaccines. Now I'm urging you to speak with your doctor to find out which vaccines you need. For more information about the vaccines that are recommended for adults and the diseases they prevent, like HPV, whooping cough, tetanus, and shingles, visit adultvaccination.org. That's www.adultvaccination.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back with a second segment with Daniel Akbari, a lawyer skilled in the tradition of Sharia law from his native Iran, and now studying the American constitutional form of law, which is extraordinarily different. And I gather something you much prefer, Daniel, here in the United States. We're delighted to have you with us. You've authored a book about honor killing and about the new jihadists and Islam. And we're trying to sort of tease out exactly what this jihad looks like in a nation like ours. Give us a flavor of some of these, in addition to the violent kind, how the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, and other Islamic supremacists try to bring Sharia here.
Traditionally, jihad has a just violent meaning. It means killing others until they submit to Islam. That's the traditional understanding of jihad, which is probably the most accurate. But nowadays in the United States or in the West, we see how Muslim Brotherhood is sneakily following the same goal of dominating the whole world by using the peaceful meanings. That's why we call them peaceful jihad. That's a loose term, but we use it, and that's fine. But the goal is the same, even though that's not jihad, but that follows the same direction that jihad is going. Jihad is to fight to dominate the whole world. They use it through violence. Nowadays, we see because Muslim Brotherhood sees that's not an efficient way in the United States to use violence, they have adopted other ways, like getting charity and sending some of that to jihadists, and at the same time using propaganda, using the lawfare, and also using the media to influence the country and bring as many as people in their fold to be able to coerce and to be able to force Sharia law in this country. That's why we call it peaceful jihad, or kind of a stealth jihad or civilized jihad, because that follows and goes to the same direction that jihad goes.
I'm not sure peaceful is quite the term. It seems to me it's kind of pre-violent, because it, as we've seen in Europe, Daniel Akbari, as you know, it's been the case that the Muslim Brotherhood, through these sort of stealthy techniques, has built up infrastructure, mosques and cultural centers and Islamic societies and front groups of various kinds, which are then drawn upon by the non-peaceful jihadists, for sure. Let me just ask you, Daniel Akbari, as a person who has gone to school, in a manner of speaking, on this business of Sharia and insinuating it where possible, stealthily in countries like ours, is it ill-advised, would you say, for the United States government or the press or others of us to be taking counsel from those directly involved with, or at least sympathetic to, the Muslim Brotherhood about what we can know and say and do about this business of jihad and the danger that it represents?
Yeah, it makes me sick to see and to hear how the system or the administration is not relying on people like Zohdi Jasser as Muslims, just trying to promote the narration that promotes Sharia. The narration of Muslim Brotherhood is being promoted and supported, and that's awful. That's going to bring this country down. We have to support Islam. We have to support Muslims. But those Muslims whose narration is innocuous, those Muslims whose narration of their religion is innocuous and harmless and peaceful, not the narration of jihadis or narration of Sharia supporters like the Muslim Brotherhood, accepting their narration and supporting their narration is super dangerous.
Hey, speaking of dangerous, you have spent time as a guard in the state prisons of Texas, as I understand it, and therefore have a particular expertise, it would seem to me, an authority to speak about a problem that is largely going unnoted. And that is, despite the attention now being focused to this idea of so-called criminal justice reform and letting lots of felons out of the federal prison system specifically, we may well find ourselves letting loose people who have converted to this kind of Sharia-adherent jihadist Islam that you've just been warning about, Daniel Akbari. How serious a threat do you think that is?
I think Muslim Brotherhood has taken over all the chaplaincy in prisons, and many mosques supported by Muslim Brotherhood are going to jail and giving money to those, to many of the inmates and convicts, and giving them and kind of showing them sympathy and showing them love to bring them to the fold of Islam. And we have seen, and we have some data that supports, one out of three blacks who go to jail convert to Islam. When they come out of jail, the mosque takes care of them sometimes and starts walking him through the process of radicalization to bring him to the point to make him jihadist, or at least making some of them to become, if you don't mind, some bullies to take it, I mean, to support their propaganda machine and to support their agenda, putting him in bars and taking him to places to help with riots. You know, I have lived among many poor people. When you are an immigrant, you know that you are not going to be in higher economic status when you come to the United States. That's why I have lived among them. I love them. So passionate people. I love black people, but poor people, they are just being trapped.
So it's not so much that the Muslim Brotherhood imams in prison are actually radicalizing these folks to become jihadists, in your experience, Daniel Akbari, as it is that when they get out, they wind up slipping into that pipeline that the Brotherhood has created in the mosques and front groups and so on to achieve that ultimate purpose of imposing Sharia in this country. And in that process, post-prison, they become radicalized. Is that your experience?
That's right. In their agenda and in their process of establishing their organization, almost all the time, Muslim Brotherhood quotes the verse, the surah or chapter 59, verse 2, that says, "We destroyed their houses, their miserable houses, with their own hands." And Muslim Brotherhood, they tell their Salafi brothers that, "You guys do not know, in the United States, we cannot use violence right away. We have to go through the process to misuse the First Amendment, to misuse the Fourth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, and misuse all the process of the constitutional rights to bring many people and radicalize them and then force the country to accept our agenda through some other Americans. For example, African Americans, as I said, passionate, great people. They misuse their power to take advantage and push to become foot soldier and kill others or get killed and pave the road for Muslim Brotherhood to establish Sharia in this country.
You know, you used a very important term there in describing the Quranic injunction. That term is used, as I'm sure you know, in a very insightful depiction of what the Muslim Brotherhood is up to in this country, called the Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America. And it specifically refers to the fact that their mission, the Brotherhood's in North America, is, quote, "destroying Western civilization from within, sabotaging its miserable house by their hands," meaning ours, "and the hands of the believers, so that God's religion is made victorious over all other religions," unquote. So this is a Quranic injunction, not just a plan of the Muslim Brotherhood. It makes it all the more ominous. Daniel Akbari, it's a delight to talk with you, and I appreciate so much your insights, both from your time in your native Iran and those you've gleaned in American prisons and that you're learning about in the American law schools. It's incredibly important, and we appreciate it. Hope you'll be back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.